So I suggested earlier today that you've got to build on the past for the future. That is, in church life, there are times for growth, there are times for reform, occasionally there are times for reinvention. But reinvention is when everything is actually collapsed around about you. That's when you'd go for reinvention. Most places don't require reinvention, they require reforming. But reforming is a lot more difficult. And so what we tend to do is continue to live in the past rather than to reform. Or we try and reinvent and throw out the good things that are there rather than just trying to reform what's there. That is, to build on the past for the future, you've got to recognise that each building step requires some kind of change. For as we grow, we change. But each time we change, we risk. We risk losing people. We risk losing momentum. We risk losing the institution. Change is unhelpful to us in some ways. That is, the denominations that have the longest pastorates are the denominations which grow the most. Now, always those kinds of correlations, you've got to remember, don't necessarily prove causation. But yet, it is interesting that those congregations where they change pastorates quite quickly are the ones that don't grow. And you can understand it to some extent. That is, every time you change the rector, you actually lose people. That's just one of the things that happens. You lose people when the old rector goes. The new rector comes, and for a little while, some new people will come along as well, and you get a little bit of growth happening, and there's that honeymoon period. But within a short time, some of the people, often amongst the nominating panel who invited the new rector, leave. Another place in which we lose people is when they change church themselves. I remember Alan Patrick teaching me many years ago. He noticed, he was the rector at French's Forest, Alan noticed that the people in his churches who had never been in any other Christian fellowship but the fellowship of the church hardly ever survived the change of marriage and leaving home to find another church. Whereas those that had been in ICF or Beach Mission or, you know, AFES or something like that, who had connected to Christians in other contexts, when they had to leave and move church, they could find their way into another church. He said it was quite strong, and he actually encouraged all his people to be involved in something outside their own congregation so as to learn how to be a Christian rather than just a member of St. Albans. Because once you move out of St. Albans, you don't know what you are anymore. And there's just that kind of, Alan was full of that kind of worldly wisdom. And I've watched over the years, and there is a truth to it, that he's onto something there, because we do see people drop out at the point of change. And so bringing about change in church is always a risky business. But yet, you can't build, you can't grow without changing things, because building and growing creates change, and the right change will bring building and growing as well. So what we need to do is to build on the past for the future. Grasping and understanding the past, why things are the way they are, how they've come to be where they are, helps you understand what it is that you are changing, what it is you're risking in losing, what it is you hope to gain by changing. But it's much better to do that than start all over again from fresh. Now, personally, psychologically, just as a man, I much prefer to reinvent the wheel. I like that excitement rather than reforming. But just because I like it does not mean that it's a good thing to do. In fact, in general, because I like something, it's most likely a bad thing to do. You don't start on that basis. You really shouldn't start from all over fresh again unless the present is so dysfunctional that there's no other way to regain the good things from the past. And that happens at times. When I went to St. Matthias, the largest congregation they'd had since the First World War was 35 people. That's a long period of time. to actually go into the doldrums, and they hadn't been able to pay their way for something like 50 years. That's fairly dysfunctional. That is a time to start all over again, something new. Even then, we didn't actually get rid of everything. Half the congregation, the 35 that were there, left in protest at my appointment, which only left 18, most of whom came at 8 o'clock communion, and so we continued 8 o'clock communion for quite a year or two, until one summer I couldn't persuade anybody to come and look after them, and so they decided they'd go to the 9:30, and when they went to the 9:30, there were all these young people there, and they decided they didn't want to have the 8 o'clock anymore, so we finally got rid of it. But even then, I didn't immediately move in and remove everything, and tried to hang on to what was of value in the past. Second point, main point for the second talk, this talk is looking at our recent past and the future. Well, the recent times I've been looking and interrogating the National Church Life Survey people and their book about who doesn't go to church and why. And in some committee meetings and some work we've been doing, we've been looking very hard at who it is that doesn't go to church. It's just part of trying to work out, well, how do we get people to come to church, etc. And who it is that doesn't go to church can be fairly easily defined as a young male with different sexual ethics and no belief in God. That is, they look at the people, a big survey of 8,000 or so people, and they ask them all kinds of hundreds of questions. In amongst the questions, there are questions about going to church. You then pick out the group that don't go to church and see what are the characteristics of the person who doesn't go to church. Younger people rather than older people. The older you are, the more likely you are to go to church. Now, of course, that can tell you different things, can't it? It could tell you that, you know, as we get closer to death, we all think about it more seriously. Or it could tell you that a fashion change has happened. Going to church was fashionable but it's now shifted. Is there a cultural change? Could be that certain facets of life get people to change. It could be that when you get to old age, there's not much alternative. Little nippers is over, little athletics won't have you anymore. And so what else can you do on Sunday morning but go to church? There's lots of explanations, but it is a worry that each 5 years or so, the age of non-church going gets 5 years older. That makes it sound like a cultural shift has happened. That is very, therefore, significant and worrying to us. Male, across the generations, the people who go to church are 60% female, 40% male. Sydney Anglicans is better than average. It's 42 and 58. Not much better, but better is better. And there are most of Anglicanism is worse than that kind of, but 60-40 is the kind of difference. And so, therefore, a young male is even less likely to go to church than other people. Now, at what age do males stop going to church? There are all kinds of books about why men hate going to church and so on. So you ask the question, well, at what age do men stop going to church? Which I asked. And the 60-40 held through most of your adult life until your in your 80s, and then it moved to 70-30, because we men don't survive much longer than the 40 years, whereas women have got that strength that keep going. So that was about the only significant change. I said, well, how young, at what age is it in their 20s, is it in their teens, is it in their 30s? When do men stop going to church? The statistics go back to 10-year-olds, and they found at the age of 10, the figure was 60-40. Men don't stop going to church. Men have never gone to church. Little boys don't go to church. Now, we don't know under 10 what the story is, but that is extraordinary, isn't it? But the figure is exactly the same. It means all those books about why men hate going to church are basically irrelevant, because when they were 10, they'd already decided or had decided for them they weren't going to church. Now that then gives you an idea of something to do for the future, doesn't it? We've got to reinvent SEBS, or whatever it is going to be. I'm not expecting uniforms or the rest, but if you know that we've got a problem in the fact that little boys aren't going, then the natural thing to do then is affirmative action, isn't it? That's what we're doing if it was little girls not coming. Well, it's little boys that are not coming, so we move for affirmative action. So we concentrate on little boys, but we've got to work out what to do before they're age 10 to actually start attracting them in. So how do you run programs for little boys? One of the problems our society has come across of recent times in our educational system, of course, is the feminisation of the education system, where little boys are treated like little girls and, by and large, fail to do nearly as well as little girls because they're not little girls. And so working out a boys program is a really important way forward for the future. It's not going to bring about a change in statistics. If it succeeds, it's not going to bring about a change in statistics for another 10, 20 years. But if that's right, then we've got to start now. No point waiting 20 years. You lose the children in one generation, you've lost the teenagers in the next, you lose the teenagers in the next, you lost the family in the next. So it's really critical that we look at the little boys. And the difference in sexual ethics, well, that's become quite an apparent one. That is, belief in God and non-belief in God is one of the characteristics of people who don't go to church. That's not altogether surprising. You don't need to get a PhD on that one, do you? But what is quite starkly interesting is whether they vote Labor, whether they vote Liberal, there's not much difference. Whether they this, whether they that, not much difference. But sexual ethics, almost total difference. That really says that something has happened of enormous importance to our community. That as the community moves to de facto relationships, as it moves to divorce and remarriage, as it moves to acceptance of homosexuality, so it moves away from a Christian worldview and from church involvement and church practice. Well, if that is the case, then what do we need to be doing about it and who needs to be doing what? On the little boy one, well, that's an issue that nearly needs to be taken up at the local church, doesn't it? That is, our Anglican Youth Works or Kid Starts or things like that can come up with some programs to help the local church do it, but it's the local church that's going to reach the little boys. It's not anybody in church house is going to reach the little boys. But what do you do on the subject of sexual ethics and morality? Now, that seems to me something that we actually need to do corporately. We need to start working with our friends in the media, with our friends in research into social relationships and into relationship counselling, into sexual counselling, into the statistics. We need to change the culture. And that needs to be argued at all kinds of levels. It needs to be argued in the personal development courses of the schools. It needs to be argued at the university levels. It needs to be argued in the government at the government levels. It needs to be challenged at the media level and so on. Because you go to the media, young journalists who run the media, because most of the journalists these days are young, that is, they're in their 20s, and their kind of sexual behaviour and pattern means that they've never met anybody who actually believes in the kind of old-fashioned things that Christians teach. It's a completely different world for them, because they're part of that world that doesn't go to church. And so the Christians in the media, critical ministry to be taking on, but critical that we actually wrestle on this issue, because this is the issue that has unhinged our society from Christianity more than any other issue. It's a very important one. And of course it's an incarnational issue, it's not a just mental issue. By incarnational I mean it's done physically. And so once you've had a divorce, will you be accepted in church? Once you've had an abortion, will you be accepted in church? Once you've set up in a de facto relationship, will you be accepted in church? It's not just, well, I think it's okay. It's, this is how I live. And those people don't like the way I live. Therefore, I'm not one of those people, am I? And as the non-Christian pattern of sexual relationships increases in our society, so Christianity decreases in our society. Well, if that is the case, and I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming, as best I can see, cross-examining it, that is the case, if that is true, then this is a central issue that we must really fight about and argue for. That is, what we've seen over the last 50 years is the collapse of Christianity, but it really happened in the 40 years, the last 40 years of the 20th century. I guess it happened one night in 1968, to be precise. That was the year of the revolutions, 1968. All kinds of revolutions. But especially, more than almost any of the other cultural revolutions, was the sexual revolution that took place in the 1960s. That was the one, more than any other one, which transformed our society away from Christianity. It's fascinating, you see. In 1959, Billy Graham came to Sydney, and Sydney turned out to the Billy Graham Crusade. You only have to see the photos of the thousands and thousands of people who went out there. In 1964, the Beatles came to Sydney, and the same size crowds went out to the Beatles. And that's 5 years. What a social change happened in 5 years. What an extraordinary change happened in 5 years. Because make no bones about it, the Beatles were actually preaching everything anti-God, anti-Christ. They were the sexual revolutionaries. They were for the drugs. They were for anything and everything that was going, and that was it. Hedonism written large. We were too scared to go along with saying that, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll. Because you said it, you were made to look stupid. But I've seen some non-Christians writing recently saying, you know, maybe Mary Whitehouse was right. Because she was. She wasn't a particularly Christian. She was a moral rearmament woman. But she actually said this is what would happen, and basically what she said would happen has happened. But she was laughed at and pilloried and scorned at the time. And we didn't particularly stand up. Some of us did, some of us didn't particularly stand up. But the sexual revolution of the 1960s, which had been building up for most of the 20th century, but came, of course, when the baby boomers reached young adulthood. That you had the rebellion against their parents, who never stopped talking about the war and the great victory they had won. And if the baby boomers had lived for the war, they would have agreed. But they didn't. They lived under their parents, who kept on going on about it. And so short haircuts from the Second World War became the long hair of the 1960s, and everything the parents stood for, the teenagers rebelled against, only the teenagers far outweighed the adults on this occasion. This massive boom of baby boomers through, who were going to change everything, and they certainly did. The cultural changes came around not only the sexual revolution, but three other isms that I think have just now dominated our society and culture in a way that they didn't in the 1950s. Materialism, individualism, and hedonism. They're all interconnected, and they're all the more polite face of atheism, frankly. People were materialistic. People have always been materialistic. People have always been individualists and hedonists. But the society as a whole wasn't. You know, during the Great Depression, it was considered to be a shameful thing for a family to have two incomes when there were so many people out of work. And so people voluntarily chose not to take a job because they didn't want to inconvenience the other families because other families needed. Well, John Chapman tells me that when the house next door to them down in Oatley burnt down, half the family moved next door to their side, half the family moved in with Chapo's family, and for 2 years they lived with this split family, half and half there, while the house was rebuilt, and then they moved back into the house. Can you see that happening in the suburbs of Sydney today? I mean, it's the only one I've ever heard of, but it fits within the culture and the time frame when people were living like that. That's just what happened. My father-in-law fell over on the escalator at Miranda Fair. He had taken the trolley onto the escalator, even though a big sign saying not to do so. And it was chock-a-block full with food. He was in his 80s at the time, and halfway up it toppled back on top of him. And he was really proud of himself because he caught the eggs on the way and not one of them had broken. But he had terrible kind of stripes all up his back, you see, from and he was in. So they carted him off to hospital. It was fascinating because everybody born after the Second World War said to him, you should sue Westfield. They got lots of money. Sue them. And everyone born before the Second World War said, you silly old goat, George, what were you doing on the escalator? It's just this total cultural shift of difference that has to do with materialism. George and his friends, and I noticed it with others, Chapo's another illustration. I mean, both my father-in-law and Chapo are quite extroverted personalities, but I've noticed the culture. When they went shopping, they never went shopping. They went down to the shops to meet their friends and while they were there, picked up a few things they needed. And so even when he went to Miranda Fair, he would go from shop to shop saying hello to people serving in the shops, even though he wasn't going to buy anything there. And he would even sometimes take them some vegetables and things like that that he'd grown in his garden. And the young girl serving by the counter, they thought this was a strange old man, but it wasn't a strange old man. It was the way old men, the way a generation lived. We don't live in that world now. Now, everything is decided on the basis of materialism. There was a government report I read in 1999 about the breakdown of relationships in Australia. And they worked it out as to how much it cost. That's fascinating. Even when they're discussing relationships in a government report, the only thing that can work as an argument is it costs the society $3 or $4 billion a year in costs of lawyers, costs of divorce courts, costs of lack of work, loss of work time, loss of... They calculated out the money terms. Because if you've got a money term to it, then it's something we've got to deal with. But if there's no monetary concern, it doesn't matter, you see. Materialism rules. Individualism rules. And individualism's a killer. Absolute killer. So more and more people are living alone. There is a fastly growing rate of the number of people living alone. It's within a few years, I can't remember the exact details, but within a few years there'll be more people in a single... No, there'll be more single... I've got to get this right. There'll be more single family residences than family residences. That's not to say there'll be more people living alone than in the family, because every family residence has four or five people living in it, whereas every single residence has one person living in it, in case you hadn't understood. And so, of course, you've got to have four or five times the number of... never mind. Anyway, there are more and more people living alone. Now, nothing... there's no crime in living alone. But, of course, there's a terrible tragedy in loneliness, isn't there? And how do you make a society that's built on living alone? Now, it's been done in a thousand little incremental decisions, often by governments. Incremental decisions. Now, I remember when our children, so this must have been 1980s, 1990s, instead of their mother being given the child endowment, the individual children were. That's a very significant shift. So instead of the money going to the family, it actually started going to the children. Very, very big shift and change in the attitude to society. And there's a whole range of these ones whereby we push every individual to be an individual rather than seeing humanity as being basically built upon families interconnected with each other. Well, of course, out of it comes the terrible divorce rise. So when you go to a counsellor, you always need to ask the question, is this a marriage counsellor, a relationship counsellor, or is this a counsellor? Because if it's a counsellor, they'll tell you, walk out of the marriage, forget about it, just look after yourself, number one. That's their, see, self-determination means they're looking after the self, the client. The client is a lone client. And if this marriage is not helping my client, then I help my client get out of this marriage. Whereas a marriage counsellor, he's got two clients in a union and he's actually working on the relationship rather than the individual. But most of us don't think like that. We say, I'm going to see the counsellor. But the counsellor often will be actually the individualist counsellor rather than the family relational counsellor. That's a different way of thinking. There are just so many illustrations. I won't go. Hedonism is the other one. See, the family, the generation that came back from the war were the builders. That's what they were. They rebuilt the nation. And they rebuilt the empire too. They were sending food parcels for years and years and years across to England because the English were still on rations for years and years after the war. And so it was just absolutely normal for Australians to bundle up the food parcels to send across to Britain at Christmas time. Completely normal, regular thing to happen and to do because they were the builders. There were terrific floods in Maitland in the early 50s. And so what happened? Oh, the community gathered up all their clothing and sent it up in huge trucks up to Maitland to help all the families who'd been washed away. Their clothes had been, possessions had been washed away. Toys were given. A whole range. But it wasn't money. It wasn't an insurance company compensating you. It wasn't governments coming in and compensating you. It was just people in the streets going up and taking up their excess possessions to look after the people in Maitland in the great floods. That kind of society has now disappeared. We don't have that kind of culture anymore. What we have now, of course, is hedonism. That's the pursuit of pleasure. Pleasure, if it makes me feel good, do it. That's the motto that came out. And greed is good, of course, came in the 80s. But it just is the way of life. And, of course, drugs, sex, rock and roll, it all fits together. When you put those things together, the sexual revolution, materialism, individualism, hedonism, we have a culture that is heading as fast as it can away from God. But it has destroyed more than us. Do not beat ourselves up about church and the lack of church attendance and things. This combination of society's norms has destroyed the union movement. Labour government can't rule with the unions anymore because the unions don't have enough members to be able to win Parliament anymore. That's why Labour has had to move to a social radical revolution kind of attitude to try and pick up the kind of green votes because it can't rely itself upon the unions. Newspapers are in serial decline. It's going. The newspapers are going. What amuses me, annoys me, irritates me, is the newspapers are always recording how often church numbers are going down, but they don't tell you how often newspapers are going down. When I was a boy, we had the Herald and the Telegraph in the morning and the Mirror and the Truth in the evening. And there was another one, the Sun. The Mirror, the Sun and the Truth in the evening. We had five newspapers in Sydney. In Sydney alone, five newspapers. We're down to two newspapers for Sydney now, plus the Australian, whatever that is. And so, but the circulation of both of them are going down so that now they're giving them away in order to maintain sufficient circulation to make their advertising lucrative enough for people to be able to... Soon the newspapers will be complete freebies. Nobody will be paying for their newspapers. And it's not just that, picture theatres. Every suburb had picture theatres. I grew up around Bondi Junction, there were four picture theatres there. None of them exist today, of course. They've all been pulled down. There's a new set, of course, that has come through the Westfield, but the picture theatres were the norm. They're gone. Team sport is not played as it used to be. Oh, there are some parts of Sydney it is. I was driving through the Shire the other day, and there they all were, but of course the Shire still lives in the 1950s, so... But across Sydney, the character of team sport has gone. Public transport has gone. It's not for nothing that the whole tram system, which was one of the biggest tram systems in the world, was ripped up from Sydney because the motor car came. Motor car fits in with materialism, hedonism, individualism. Now, of course, we've got a city that's choked with our hedonism, materialism and individualism, and we haven't got a public transport system that can do anything about it, and we've got a Labor... Never mind. And... The lending libraries, which were everywhere, they disappeared. Everybody owns their own, don't they? And the family has been under terrific stress. As fewer and fewer families survive intact. I've reached the age of life where I read obituaries. Excuse me, it comes a little after the time of going to antique shops. But before the time you get in the rocking chair and can't remember how to turn the engine on. And so I noticed in the modern obituaries, hardly anybody has only been married once. Start checking out the Sydney Morning Herald. Now, one of the little surveys I want to do is to get a month of Sydney Morning Heralds from the 2010 and get a month of the obituaries from, say, 1980 and another month from the 1950s and just do a comparison, because I am sure that the rise of the destruction of the family and other organisations, scouts, guides, bowling clubs. You know, is there any bowling club? We church people should all join bowling clubs. They're good properties, flat ground, easy to build on. That is, we have gone through massive social change in the last part of the 20th century. Humongous cultural change. That the church has survived at all is miraculous, given what else has disappeared in the same period of time. But the church has also gone through this change. How? There's a couple of things that are obvious. Firstly, we've been marginalised. And this can be good, can be bad. I'll talk more about the good and the bad in a moment or two. But we've been marginalised. We're no longer in the centre of the culture. We're no longer part of the establishment of the culture. In one sense, we never were. That is, if you remember your history, the first church that was built was not built by the government, but built by the chaplain and was burnt down overnight. We never really were wanted in the first place. However, it was people like Governor Macquarie who insisted that church have its place in society. It was part of how he civilised the society, was to insist upon church, and indeed set aside the land for the cathedral, for example. And so we have the cathedral right next door to the town hall at the highest point of the city building blocks, etc., set aside by the government, and there is that sense of establishment. It's still there, and I feel it from time to time. Last week, not yesterday, the week before, the Governor-General chose to come to church at the cathedral. She just rang up and said, I'm coming to church. Is that all right? We said, yes. And so, you know, since I've been the Dean of the Cathedral, Prime Ministers I know by name. I know governors by first name. And what's worse, they know me by first name now. And so you still have that sense of establishment, and yet we never really were. And now it's quainter and antiquated that we are. When I was a boy, the president of the PNC was the rector. He always sat on the stage at prize giving. There were no Catholics in the local school. There were Jews, but they, of course, were second-class citizens in a white Australia world. And so who was the local? The local person was the rector. And that was normal. That was to be expected. There was nothing unusual, abnormal about that. So the church has gone through this enormous marginalisation as more and more activities that church used to do are stripped away from them, taken away from us. This has been happening for a couple of hundred years, but it really sped up in the last 50 years. And we've got this diminished attendance, which had to do with more with children and youth than with adults. That is where it's really hurting us. That is, every child used to go to Sunday school, and a large number went on to youth fellowship. And every adult sent their child along to Sunday school, but not every adult went. And they would go Christmas and Easter, but they wouldn't go every week. How many people actually did go to church in the 40s and 50s and 60s is hard to work out, but certainly the children did. And when they did go to church, it was more about form than substance. That is, the gospel was deeply compromised across the churches of the land. The Baptists were not compromised. They were the extremist fanatics, but the Presbyterians and the Anglicans totally compromised. The Methodists were a little bit like the Baptists, and they were extremists. And the Catholics believed what they believed because they also were not part of the establishment. But the establishment churches, it told you more about your Scottish heritage or about your English heritage than it is about what you believed. And the number of non-evangelical churches in the Diocese of Sydney were quite large. And indeed, there was quite a revolt in the late 1930s against Howard Mole. And 30 or so of the leading clergymen of the diocese wrote in against Howard Mole in public against him in a way that is almost unthinkable today, both in terms of us ever writing against our Archbishop of the day or the fact that we would be in such violent theological, ecclesiastical kind of difference. Churchmanship is dead in Sydney. It wasn't back in the 30s. Liberalism is dead in Sydney. It wasn't in the 30s. The evangelical, consistency across the Diocese of Sydney is quite a modern new phenomenon. More of that in a moment. Thirdly, then, while I move to it, is the collapse of evangelical. That is, in the 60s to the 2000s, we gained momentum over liberals and Catholics, but we split and were gutted by charismatics and Pentecostals. And yet we remained a nucleus wherever we stuck to our guts, and to stuck to our guns, I meant to say, but to our guts as well. That is, I went to university in 1960, whatever it was, three, and in those days the SCM was a slightly smaller than the Evangelical Union. But by the 1970s, the SCM had gone out of existence. SCM was the liberal student movement. So in the 60s, SCM were just wiped out completely, whereas the Evangelical Union continued on. But then when the 70s came, the late 60s, the 70s, the EU was split over the charismatic issue and never really kind of recovered from the split that happened. Different people handled it differently. It didn't affect the churches as much as the universities as much as it affected the churches. But most of the evangelical churches, which were growing and growing strongly and forcefully, were then completely divided. People left. It was a dreadful time, really. However, wherever people stuck to their guns and remained true to what they believed, they continued on in evangelicalism. So, during this period, there were some inventions and some reinventions. Some of them were useless. Some of them were really quite helpful. Where am I up to? Point 2C. Yes, I'm making it. What they tried, what we tried, was liturgical inventions and reinventions. And frankly, they missed the boat entirely. The problem was not which liturgy, but whether liturgy. They thought that if we just kind of modernised the language, people would continue going to church. The problem wasn't modernising the language. The problem was having reality and authenticity in church. That was the problem. And that problem was not actually caught up with liturgy. That problem was caught up with the compromised nature of the church. I can't generalise from my own congregation, but I will. That is, in the church I grew up in, every member of the parish council except for one was a member of the local Masonic lodge. And as best I understand, that was relatively normal. The Masonic Lodge, a lot of the clergy, some of the bishops, were Masons. Unthinkable now. Not unthinkable in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. Quite normal. Most churches had Masonic services. And there were some great evangelicals who stood out against it. D.J. Knox stood out against it. And St. Paul's Chatswood, I think it was at Gladesville, he preached a famous sermon on the stone that the Masons rejected. So there were some standouts, but the man Keith Shelley, a very famous minister and a great man, he took the Masons on at St. Paul's Chatswood, and his life was made an absolute misery for having done so. And yet he stood firm for the cause of the gospel of the Lord Jesus. So there were standouts against it, but you had to stand out against it in the Diocese of Sydney back then. Now, in the 1920s, before T.C. Hammond came to Moore College, the thing that held the principal and the vice-principal together, because they disagreed theologically and ecclesiologically and everything, the thing that held them together was they belonged to the same lodge. The principal and vice-principal of Moore College, who were there for quite a long period of time. And of course, their clergy, the ones they trained, were the ministers in the 40s and 50s. And so Now they thought, well, if we modernise the liturgy, it didn't make a difference at all. It was a failure, really. There were more non-liturgical changes. That is, as we were hearing earlier this evening, the doctrine of the church and ministry were worked out by Broughton and by Donald Robinson in particular. And that made a huge difference because we moved from clergy being functionaries to being relational. That is, before that, you had a clergyman. He was a standard clergyman. He read the prayer book service. He preached a sermon which may or may not have any importance or significance in the life of the church. And he could be moved on. Well, he could choose to move on. It made no difference to the church. Another one who would dress in exactly the same clothing, reading exactly the same book, would take his place. That's what you did. We also did it because it was such a large thing. You had no choice, really. Even when I was ordained down at St. Matthew's Manly in 1971, we ran three or four weddings every Saturday afternoon. Well, you can't enter into deep, meaningful personal relationships when you're running through three or four weddings every afternoon. You were doing three or four funerals every week. That was just normal St. Matthew's Manly fare. That's the tail end of what these people were going through in the 30s, 40s, 50s. They were just running funerals and running weddings. They were a person in the community, but they weren't engaged in deep personal relationships with anybody. You couldn't be so. That was not a possibility, given the workforce and the opportunities they had. And it was this lack of relationship, this lack of genuineness that really got to the evangelicals. And so there were organisational renovations and reinventions at the time. The Katoomba Christian Convention almost went bankrupt in the early 70s, and through the Katoomba Youth Convention came back into its own. AFES in the 1980s, and there were other organisations that were started up, like Matthias Media, which I'm saying here because Tony Payne's in the back row, and MTS, I'll say, even though Col Marshall's not around, and nor is Ben Farlow. It was in 2000 and 2010 that we actually started to see the reinvention take place. That is, what took place from 1960 through to 2000 is what I call the great pruning. God pruned the church. And we got rid of a whole host of stuff that had nothing to do much with Christianity. It had to do with English hangover. Remember, migrants are always more old-fashioned than the country they've come from. Because you leave in 1930 and you don't know what's happened in 40 and 50 and 60 back in the home country. So you're in 1930. We were old-fashioned British people. Much more old-fashioned than the Brits were. That's what we were. So we hung on to these traditions when everybody else in the world had given them up long since. And hanging on to those traditions was hanging on to a sense of national church rather than Christian church. And that really was a significant difference. But God pruned us through the rise of materialism, hedonism, and he's pruned us and taken away many of these things that were there and got back to the bare bones of what Christianity is. And so I believe the church is healthier today than it has ever been in my lifetime. Because people come to church because they want to come to church. People come to church to hear the word of God and to meet with their Christian brothers and sisters. And when we get to church, we have fellowship that is meaningful and real and purposeful. We're here because we're here to serve the Lord Jesus Christ. But with some difficulties. In 2000, from around about late 90s through the first decade of this century, we'll take 2000 as the changing point, the diocesan mission has taken effect. And that is being possible because we're now building on a common theology thanks to Moore College and thanks to the pruning of the last 40 or 50 years. We've done what you cannot do in other systems like ours. A very few dioceses of the world could ever run a mission like ours because you don't get everybody with a theological basic agreement about evangelism, or at least substantially enough of us to agree to actually do it. And so we've done it by raising up more ministers, we've done it by planting new churches, we've done it by renovating old churches. The full effect of what we've done may not be felt for another 10 or 15 years. It's got to do with persisting in doing it. But it has happened. Let me show you a couple of graphs on what's happened. Here is a picture, for example, of, we're going to do it, the population growth from 1966 through to 2006 in the, what do you call that? Bishop colour graph that goes up. And the other one, thank you, the other one is the number of parishes in Sydney. You see what we've done in that period of time? We've never planted any more parishes while the population has moved from below 2.5 million to nearly 4.5 million. But we're stuck with 270 parishes. Well, that's losing market share. That's what that's called technically. But if you think that's bad, look at the next one, because it's actually worse. That is, that's the number of actual church buildings we had. You see, many a church had 2 or 3 buildings. Well, we sold them, didn't we? And so, whereas we used to have lots of church openings, you know, the church here would have three churches in a parish, each of which would run services. We got down to 1 parish church, and so we actually closed from 500 churches down to about 350 churches. Where is all the money gone? Well, we've spent it on ourselves, frankly. It's nice chairs you've got here, isn't it? And much nicer than last time I was here. Now, that is an appalling. You see, that... Not the chairs. The black line should be going up with the pink line. As you get more and more people living in the community, you should be opening up new churches. After all, we're not building mega churches, we're building 300-seaters. So we should be building more and more. But we're doing the exact reverse for 50 years. The next one shows you, a little bit more complicated. We've got the green line is now the number of church buildings. The flat line is still the parishes. The population's still going up. But the really funny one, that's the number of clergy. Now, do you see what's happening? We were going downhill with the number of clergy just like we were going downhill with the number of church buildings until around 1990, 86, 90, when suddenly we started to grow again. Now, what the mission is about has been trying to capture that growth in full-time gospel ministers. Because in the end, it's not the number of buildings you have open or the number of buildings you own, but the number of gospel preachers who are preaching the gospel that matters to us. And so, in 2002, when we started the diocesan mission, for example, there were 72 assistant ministers in the Diocese of Sydney. Today, there are 183. I think that's the next slide, if we put it up just to give you the figures. We've got the next one there or not? No, we've got another one. Oh, you see the growth in more college students. The purpley one are the ordinands for the diocese. The yellow one are just the Anglicans. And the top one's just the total number of students has grown. That should be the two added together, but it doesn't make sense to me in a couple of places there in that graph. But you'll see the growth in Anglicans coming to college. Up until around 2000, they were dropping. But now, suddenly, Anglicans have said, no, we're going to be involved here. We're going to do this. And some of them, an increasing number of them, in order to be ordained. So, the next one. We have 2002, there were 72 assistant ministers, now there's 183. That is in an 8-year period. That is a significant shift. Right? That's a quantum shift. What is the outcome of that kind of shift, really? Right? Well, we don't know. It depends where they're deployed. Are they deployed to make our seats more comfortable, or are they deployed to preach the gospel to the unbelievers? Are they going to do cross-cultural ministry to reach the new Sydney, or are they going to look after an ever-aging group of old-timers who ought to be had their hands held? What is going to happen? Where are they being deployed is a critical factor then in that whole mission at that point, isn't it? But when you look at the number of church plants that we have, now I had the numbers here somewhere, between 2002 and 2006 we knew of 136 new congregations opening. Well, you see, we've spent 50 years closing congregations. Now we've spent 5 years opening congregations. Of course, many of them are quite small. Well, that's what happens when they start. They all start small, that's the character of it. But over time, if you consist and persist with the teaching of the gospel, You see, there was a time when St Paul's Carlingford fitted in the old St Paul's building, which was about a quarter of the size of this room. Now St Paul's Carlingford is covering all kinds of buildings, all kinds of congregations. It just is time and application of the gospel ministry. So where to now? Well, we must never forget the basics. That's the temptation. Great temptation to us to forget the basics. We've got to teach the word of God. We've got to see Jesus Christ as the cornerstone of the church. We've got to pray. We've got to commit ourselves to this work of the gospel. We've got to pray for this city and its evangelization. The culture which we're trying to reach has changed us so that we are no longer in the center as the establishment. We are now on the margins as a cult. We've got to change our mentality to being, I think Bruce called it, everyone's a missionary. That's a nicer way of saying everyone's a cult. Cult members don't think of themselves as part of the establishment. They think of themselves as countercultural. They're out to win the land. We've got to stop thinking of ourselves as the establishment and think of ourselves as the missionaries. Not just the clergy, the laity. We're all in it. And Protestant Christianity has given us multicultural society, which therefore gives us the opportunity of cross-cultural ministry. We've got the world come to our door. For years we went to the world, now the world's come here. We need to be outreaching them with the gospel. The city of Sydney itself, downtown where I'm working, it's extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary, for the sheer number of Asians who are living on our doorstep, many of them not hostile to Christianity, some of them quite interested in just finding out about Christianity, especially those who have come from mainland China, where they haven't had the opportunity of finding out about Christianity, who are living on our doorstep. We used to pray for China and the evangelization of China. Just walk up and down George Street handing out tracts. They're there. It's everywhere around about us in the centre of the city of Sydney. And so, in the last year or two, we started connecting with outsiders in the Connect 09 program. It's just the beginning. If it finishes at the end of 09, it was a blip of no significance. But where it's come to institutionally, organisationally, is now to organise mission districts so that we can actually start to see the regions we worked at were far too big and large to actually direct and organise the ministry of the gospel. It's the districts that have a chance of peer group support and help that we can work together on seeking to actually be mission-minded in our local area. Fundamental to this is the shift from being church pastors to parish ministers. Or if you like, make it clearer, parish missionaries. A parish is an area of ground in which people live. A congregation, a church is a congregation. In any parish area, there can be several congregations and churches. What we have done is we've withdrawn into being congregational pastors. But we need to be parish missionaries. That's a different thing. And that mindset is quite hard to take hold of. And unfortunately, friends, we have a kind of codependency relationship with our congregations and pastors. The congregations want to be looked after by the pastor, and the pastor wants to feel good that he's doing something worthwhile by having the congregation depend on him. And so we run this ever smaller circle when we have to free our minds up to say, no, we as the congregation are those who are going to be responsible for the evangelization of this area. And our minister, he's the head leader honcho of our evangelistic efforts. He needs to be working out how to evangelise the 20,000 people living in the suburb rather than constantly being held in the hands of the 150 who are still coming to church with us. You see it in children's work. When I went to Sunday school, every child went to Sunday school except those who went to Saturday school because I grew up in Bellevue Hill. But they all went. Today, who's in your Sunday school at your church? It's the children of the congregation. It's run for the church children, the church families. Well, there were only two families in our church where the children had parents at church. All our other children that we were in Sunday school and in youth fellowship, none of them went to church. So that it was normal that your youth fellowship was made up of people whose parents weren't Christians. Whereas today, the youth fellowship is normally made up of people whose parents are Christians. Well, if we're going to really have a very active sex life, we may be able to biologically breed Australia back into Christianity. But generally, that's not the route we wish to be going, although it's an enjoyable route. It's generally not the way we want to be going. The way we want to be going is by preaching the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. That is the way and the direction. Now, the character then of our church life needs to change. And it needs to change significantly. We've got to be concerned for the lost. We've got to look outwards. We've got to look at the suburbs and the people around about us. And one minister, one church is not going to do that. That's why we need to start, get rid of some of the kind of parochialism and start working with each other in planting new congregations, in working on new groups that we can't be reaching by ourselves, but we can, in collaboration with others, reach others. And we need to look at the children. Look at boys under 12, under 10. Say, well, what can we put on for the local kids? Not for the church kids, for the local kids. What sports do we need to run on Saturday mornings for local kids that can actually engage ourselves, connect ourselves back to the community? If we're going to evangelise, you've got to think like a missionary, not think like the church pastor of an established church. It's a different way of thinking in mindset. The community as a whole, Christians and denominations as a whole, have got to tackle things like the sexual revolution to change the cultural landscape. But we also need to raise up another generation of ministers. We've done well in seeing an increase in the ministers, but if we now stop, we're not going to go. We've got to keep pushing that. That's why that October long weekend is so critical. It's not just a weekend to recruit people into ministry. It's actually to develop a network of mission-minded people. That's why I like Nexus. I think it's a good name. It's yours, is it, Gary? It's a good one. Works well. It's lovely to be in a group where we're not being tape recorded, not being going to go around the world. I can let my hair down in the sense of being able to share with you what I'm thinking as the other speakers can, and actually know most of people by name, and that's a lovely feeling to be. Here is where we need. We need to build the network of like-minded Christians who are going to start praying for the evangelisation of Sydney. That's what we need. And that's what this weekend of October is about, amongst young people especially, that we want you to be bringing along. We're not making it public. It has no name. It's a no-name, no conference. Because it's really about building a network and just using a weekend away in order to build that network. And we need people to bring their twos and threes along of young men and women who are going to be the prayer supporters for the next generation and the generation after and the generation after.